was wondering who Todd is. That's supposed to say today. It didn't come through on the PowerPoint quite so well. That's not a Christmas Vacation reference either, for those of you familiar with that. At any rate, Benjamin Franklin did not invent the saying, but it's probably because of Benjamin Franklin that we know the saying, that there are two things in life that are certain. What are they? Death and taxes. You ever wonder why, whoever came up with that, and it's at least over 300 years old, why whoever came up with that chose two unpleasant things? Why did they choose death and taxes as the things that are certain? Why not? There are two things in life that are certain: a sunrise and a mother's love, or something like that. Why did they have to choose something unpleasant for things that are certain? I think the reason is because we know that hardship is a certainty. When it comes to life, we know that it's not a question of if things are going to be hard. It's not a question of if we're going to have issues or challenges or problems. The Bible recognizes this. Job said in Job 5:7, man is born for trouble as sparks fly upward. It's just a natural thing. When you got a fire going in the backyard and the sparks are coming up off the wood, which direction do they go? They don't go down. They don't go down into the ground. They always go up. It's a given. It's a certainty. It's never going to be any different. They're always going to go up. And as long as we live on this earth, it is a fact, it's a certainty that we're going to have difficulty. The uncertainty, the only question, the only thing we don't know is how we're going to handle it. That's what we don't know. We know we're going to have the problem. The question is, how will we handle the problem? And that's where the life-changing equation comes in. Now, I did not make this up. As far as I know, Jack Canfield, the chicken soup for the soul guy, he made it up as far as I know, but I know that it's true. Here's what I know: that most people look at life this way. Most people look at life as this equation, E equals O, which means the event equals the outcome. This is how most people live, that if you have a bad event, then you will have necessarily, can be no other way, you're going to have a what? Bad outcome. This is how most people live. Something bad happens, my life is bad. Right? You ask somebody, how you doing? Terrible. Having a terrible day. Why are you having a terrible day? I got up late. That was 10 hours ago. Yeah, it's a terrible day. Bad thing happened, bad day. Right? This is how most people live. If something bad happens in the morning, it's a bad day. And so most people live by this equation. However, the life-changing equation, the equation that makes everything different, is this. This is the equation that all people, well, we all live by it. We need to learn how to live by it. Here's what changes your life: that the event plus your response determine the outcome. The event plus the way you respond to it. I'll give you an example. Quite a few years ago, I went to the doctor to have my eyes checked, the eye doctor, and the eye doctor said, not only do you need glasses, but you need the dreaded B word. You don't just need glasses. Now, they call them something different now, so you don't feel so bad. But you need, anybody know? Bifocals. Listen, when I was younger, bifocals equaled 100 years old. Now they call them, what do they call them now? Progressives, is that what they call them now? But they said, you need bifocals. I was devastated. I was completely devastated. Not only do I need glasses, I need bifocals. I need old people glasses. I need these glasses that mean I'm 100 years old. But I thought, wait a minute. It's up to me how I handle this. It's up to me how I respond to this. You know, if this had been a couple of hundred years ago, and I would have had eyesight that was getting worse and worse, I would not have had a qualified, knowledgeable doctor to go to who could give me something that could make me see better. So instead of being upset that I'm 100 now, I need to be grateful that the doctor can give me something to help me see. The same thing happened several years ago, when I woke up one morning, couldn't hear out of my left ear. Just gone. Hearing gone. So I went to the doctor, perfectly certain that the doctor would say to me, well, it's no big deal. You got some fluid in there. We're going to take that care, and you're going to be right back to normal the way a young person ought to be. I did the hearing test. He came back with a look on his face that you never want to see on a doctor's face. Puzzled. Uncertain. Not sure what's going on. And so he went through all the stuff and the tests and what it meant. And he said to me, you're going to need, guess what? A hearing aid. Now talk about feeling. I already got bifocals. Now I need a hearing aid. Well, I was upset about that. Only old people need hearing aids. I don't want to need a hearing aid. I want to hear normally. But I thought, wait, hang on a second. E plus R equals O. If this would have happened 100 years ago, I could not have gone to a doctor who would have given me something that enables me to hear almost normally. I changed the response, and the outcome immediately became better. This is how we must live if we want to have the best life we can have and handle adversity in the best possible way. Here is why the R matters. This is why it matters. So you're probably facing or experiencing a difficulty right now. I know some of you are because I know what's going on with a lot of you. Health crisis, family problems, financial difficulties, work issues, some transition in life, and you're dealing with some sort of challenge. It matters the way that you handle it. And it matters for a lot of very important reasons. It matters for your own life. Proverbs 17:22 says, a joyful heart is good medicine, but a broken spirit dries up the bones. You know what that verse means? That verse means that the way that you choose to handle your difficulty is going to impact directly and very strongly the life that you live. If you choose to be joyful in the face of difficulty, it's like good medicine. It's like the doctor prescribing something to you that completely takes away your condition. But if you choose to have a broken spirit, if you choose the opposite of joy, it will destroy you. It matters for your own life. It matters for those that you love. It matters. The way that you deal with difficulty. Several years ago, when the kids were little, and I was still angry, frustrated, David, we got stuck in traffic going to Kentucky. I think it was over the holidays. There was a lot of snow. And we got stuck. It was one of those things where the interstate shut down. It's a parking lot. Nobody's going anywhere for a very long time. And I was very upset because life was supposed to cooperate with me in every possible way and always give me exactly what I wanted. And it didn't, and I didn't understand that. So instead of taking this time to enjoy talking to my kids, hanging out with my wife, just enjoying time as a family, I lost grip. I yelled. I beat the steering wheel. I snapped at everybody. I yelled at everybody. I lost my mind. Instead of understanding the way that I'm dealing with this is adversely affecting my family, my children are being hurt. My wife is being hurt by the way that I'm responding. My loved ones hurt when I don't handle adversity well. My relationship with God is going to suffer when I don't handle adversity well. You know, one of the things that we sometimes do, we'll talk about this more in a minute, one of the things we sometimes do is turn against other people. When life gets difficult, we start taking it out on other people. In James chapter 5 and in verse 9, James says this, "Do not complain against one another, brethren, so that you will not be judged." God judges you when you take your frustrations out on other people. And then your influence in the world. Let's turn and look at this for just a minute. Philippians chapter 2. This is one of the most remarkable. When I realized what this verse was saying, it blew me away. Philippians chapter 2, one of the most remarkable things that Paul says, and one of the most sobering things, Philippians 2 and verse 14. Philippians is about Christians getting along with each other. That's what the book is about. They weren't doing it well. And he's writing to them about that. And he says to them, in the midst of this, Philippians 2:14, do all things. How many things? All of them. Whatever you're doing, this is how you need to do it. Now, I know it's Christmas, and Christmas is a time of no stress, and so this may not apply this weekend. But when it's back to normal and you're stressed again, then you can come back to this. Philippians 2:14, do all things without two things. What's the first one? Grumbling. You ever talk under your breath? You ever do that? Grumbling, complaining, griping, grousing. Do all things without grumbling. So how much can you grumble and be okay? Do all things without grumbling or disputing. This is like getting into it with other people. Bickering with other people. Right? Now again, this has no application to you, I'm sure. This occasionally happens in my home, so we'll just apply it and you don't have to worry about it. But if you ever bicker with other people, dispute with other people, get into it with other people, maybe you might need to hear this. Don't grumble. Don't dispute. Now, here, this is amazing. So that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God, above reproach in the midst of a crooked perverse generation. Do you know what will demonstrate your relationship with God more than anything else if you would stop doing two things? Complaining and bickering. He says, you will stand out like a light in the world. If we would just stop complaining and stop bickering, we would shine like a light in a dark room. And people would look at us and go, wow, man, there's something different about that guy. That woman's not like other people. What is it? I'm going to watch them. Oh, they don't complain. And when somebody does something, that they don't bicker, they don't fuss, they don't gripe, they don't do those things. It makes us shine like a light in the world. Now, the reason that we're talking about this is because God is going to serve up to the Israelites in Exodus 16 some quail filet. Chick-fil-A did not come up with bird meat and bread. Now, they act like they did. Chick-fil-A acts like they're the ones who came up with bird meat and bread. They didn't. God came up with it in Exodus 16. And that's what we're going to notice for just a little bit in Exodus chapter 16. Now, here's what's happening. The Israelites have been out of Egypt for 2.5 months. And they come to this place and they don't have anything to eat right now. And they do that thing that our kids do. When we've been in the car for a couple of hours and like 15 minutes ago they just finished off the snacks and now all of a sudden, they're starving. I'm starving. I'm starving to death. When are we going to eat? I'm starving. This is what the Israelites are doing. All of a sudden they're starving. They're going to die if they don't get something to eat. So they begin to complain about food. Now this is no surprise. Do you know how many days it took the Israelites to start complaining? You know how many days it took the Israelites to start complaining after the journey? 3 days. 3 days. After all of those miracles, they begin to complain. It's sort of like, you ever hear the story about the monk who goes to live, or the guy that goes to become a monk, live in the monastery, and the rule is it's a vow of silence. You can only speak 2 words a year. You ever heard that? And so after the first year, the man hasn't been able to speak at all, and he goes to the supervisor to speak his 2 words, and he says, "Food bad." And then he goes back, spends a year in silence, comes back to his supervisor the next year and says, "Bed hard." And then he goes back, spends his year in silence, comes back to his supervisor and says his 2 words, "Food cold." And then he goes back. Well, he just can't take anymore. So a year later, he comes back to his supervisor, says his 2 words, "I quit." The supervisor says, "It's about time. You've done nothing but complain since you've been here." This is the way the Israelites are. The Israelites are constantly complaining. And so God, in this passage, is going to graciously give them bread and meat. But I want you to notice how they're acting. This is Exodus 16, 1 to 3. There's five things. That's right, five things, not three. We're going to find five, but we're not going to talk about them very long. It's okay. So I want to see if you can find the five things the Israelites do that we want to avoid when handling difficulty. There's five of them. Exodus 16 and verse 1. Then they set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin. Boy, there's a big signpost, right? The wilderness, I wonder what's about to happen. The wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departure from the land of Egypt. The whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The sons of Israel said to them, now listen to what they say, "Would that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Boy, things are bad, aren't they? What do the Israelites do that we need to be careful about? Well, we're going to talk about those things. First of all, complain, complain. We'll talk about complaining. Misery loves company. Notice how that works. Hindsight is definitely not 20/20. We're all going to die. And I know what you're thinking. Those five things the Israelites do. Talk about those for just a moment. We'll be done. So, complaining. It says that the Israelites grumbled against Moses. Now, I want you to notice the difference between complaining and legitimately seeking a solution. We need some balance here. Not everybody who says, "I have a problem," is complaining. We need to be careful about that. Not everybody who talks about their problems is complaining. Sometimes we're seeking a legitimate solution. It is not complaining for you to express your feelings, to say, "This is what's going on, this is how I feel." Perfectly legitimate. It is not complaining for you to get help for yourself, to call someone and say, "I'm struggling and I need it." Not complaining. It is not complaining for you to seek a solution to a legitimate problem from proper authorities. Let's say that as a member of this congregation, you have a problem. Let's just pull something crazy out of the hat. Let's say that you don't like the preaching. Just use that as an example. I mean, something that could never happen. That way there'll be no danger of it. So you don't like the preaching, and you get nothing out of it, and it's just not very good. In other words, you've gotten somebody else here new. And so you go to the elders and say, "I just don't get anything out of the preaching's horrible. I don't get anything out of it. There's no, it's not good." Right? That's perfectly legitimate for you to go to the elders or whoever and say, "I've got a problem, and we need to address this." That's not complaining. But what we need to be careful about is legitimate complaining. There's an interesting verse in Numbers chapter 11. took me a while to figure out what exactly this was saying. I thought it was worded kind of weird, but then I realized. It says that the people became like those who complain of adversity in the hearing of the Lord. In other words, there's a kind of person who's a habitual complainer. There's a kind of person who just complains all the time. They're never happy with anything. They gripe about anything and everything that happens. Nothing is ever good enough. They're so negative in their mindset, they gripe all the time. We don't want to be that person. They had become that. We don't want to do that. We don't want to be a person who complains habitually like they did. So that's complaining. The second thing that we want to notice is that misery loves company. Notice that in Exodus 16:2, it says the whole congregation was complaining. Do you think they all started complaining at exactly the same time? Do you think just like there's no, and then all of a sudden everybody's complaining? No, that's not how that works. How that normally works is somebody starts it. Somebody starts nitpicking. Somebody starts complaining. And then they say it to somebody else. And that person says it to somebody else. And eventually you have a lot of people upset about the thing. That's how it usually goes. And we need to be very careful about that. We need to understand that when we begin to complain and when we begin to be negative, what we're doing is threatening the congregation with parties and cliques, with division and splits and rebellion and all sorts of destructive things. There's a really important verse. I'll just give it to you. You won't turn and look at it, but if you want to note it down, Psalm 73. Psalm 73 is a psalm written by a man named Asaph. Asaph had a problem. And Asaph said, I was really struggling with this difficulty, but I kept it to myself. Because, he says, if I had spoken it, I would have betrayed the generation of your people. In other words, he says, if I started going around talking about my problem to everybody, it would have affected the entire group. And I didn't want to adversely affect the group. So we need to do what Paul says in Ephesians 4:29. Let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification, according to the need of the moment, so that it will give grace to those who hear. This congregation is always one piece of gossip, one complaint, one negative word away from division. Not because we're fragile, not because we have a lot of problems, not because we're just shot through with bad people. Every congregation is always one wrongly placed comment away from disaster. We don't want to be the one who starts it, and if it started, we don't want to be the one who keeps it going. Thirdly, hindsight, to speak in a contrary way to the cliche, hindsight is not 20/20. Did you notice what the Israelites said about life in Egypt? Did you hear what they said about life in Egypt? They said, in the land of Egypt, we sat by pots of meat and had all the bread. According to them, it was a never-ending buffet in Egypt. We just sat around and ate all the time. When they thought, now remember how long has it been? Remember how long it's been? 2.5 months. When they think about life in Egypt, they think about sitting around and eating. That's what the experience was like. You know how badly we remember the past? Do you have any idea how badly we think we remember it? I remember talking to a friend of mine who was pretty wealthy. And he and his family were doing very, very well financially. But they had a lot of problems, lots of difficulty. And I remember him saying to me, you know, he said, I think sometimes back about when we were first married, we lived in a little cracker box of a house, didn't hardly have any money. I just think about and how much happier we were back then. But you know, one thing he never did, he never gave up that wealthy lifestyle and took his wife back to that little cracker box of a house. Why didn't he do that? Because even though he thought he looked back and things were better, he knew that in reality they weren't. But we do that all the time. Sometimes we look back and we think that things are worse. Oh, it's just, you know, it's never been this hard to be a Christian. Christians have never suffered this way. I think the Christians under Rome, being fed to lions and burned alive, would probably disagree. We look at our country and we say, well, we've never been so divided. We never heard of the Civil War. I mean, we forget those things. And we look back and we see things not exactly how they are. And we do that in ways that make things look better. I said, boy, if we could just go back in time, go back to the early 2000s, is that where we want to go? We were terrified about terrorism all the time. No, let's go back to the 1970s. Things were better in the 1970s when the drug problem absolutely exploded in our country. Let's go back to the 1950s when everything was in black and white. We were watching Leave It to Beaver. And everybody was worried about Russian bombs falling on their heads. It doesn't matter what period you go back to. And the same thing is true of your own life. Things were not better back then. Things were not inherently happier back then. Things were not better. And what we do when we look back and we see it as better, we make the present harder. We look back and think, oh, things are so much better then. They weren't. But guess what? Even if they were, it doesn't matter because we're not back there, we're here. And we've got to work on this. And we don't want to make things harder than they are. This is what the Ecclesiastes writer said. Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 10. Do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? It is not from wisdom that you ask this. Why isn't it? Because they weren't better. They were no better than what we have right now. Number four, we're all going to die. We're all going to die. All right, this is what they say. Moses, you brought us out to the wilderness to kill every single one of us with hunger. All right, you ever do that? There's a word for this, catastrophizing. You ever do this? There's a member of my family, I'm not going to say who it is, probably guess without a lot of deep thinking, but there's a member of my family who does this when somebody else is driving. And this particular person, who does a lot of driving during their day, but when somebody else is driving and the smallest thing goes wrong, we're all going to die. This is it. We're done. You ever do that? Right? What does catastrophizing means? Thinking that things are going to go as wrong as they possibly can. When a challenge or a difficulty, I mean, look at what they say. We're all going to die. The whole assembly dying. And in the worst possible way, we're all just going to starve to death. We're just going to sit here and just starve to death. And it's going to be horrible, all of us, because they're catastrophizing, right? Well, you know how often the worst actually happens? I mean, when you think about the worst, how often does the worst actually happen? Well, not very often, but there'd be a pessimist out there who'll go, yeah, but sometimes it does. That's true. Look over in Habakkuk chapter 3. This has been, over the years, one of the most comforting and in many ways empowering passages that I've ever read. And I absolutely love Habakkuk chapter 3 and verse 16. You remember what's happening in Habakkuk? It's kind of funny, really. Habakkuk lives in Judah. Judah is a cesspool. Judah is a sewer. So wicked. And Habakkuk cries out to God and says, God, It's horrible. It's so wicked. Why don't you do something? And God says, I'm doing something. I'm going to judge Judah, remember with who? The Babylonians, who are 100 times worse. And Habakkuk said, well, I don't understand that. So he has this dialogue with God. But he comes to understand that God is going to bring a devastating judgment on Judah, which is where he lives. Habakkuk 3:16, I heard, and my inward parts trembled. At the sound, my lips quivered. Decay enters my bones, and in my place I tremble, because I must wait quietly for the day of distress, for the people to arise who will invade us. Habakkuk has gotten the thing that a lot of people want that we don't really want, and that is, he knows what's coming. He knows what's ahead. Sometimes we think we want that. We don't really want that. He knows what's coming, and it's going to be horrible. Here's what he says, verse 17. The worst is literally going to happen. Verse 17. Though the fig tree should not blossom, and there be no fruit on the vines, though the yield of the olive should fail, and the fields produce no food, though the flock should be cut off from the fold, and there be no cattle in the stalls. Now, to us, that stuff doesn't mean a lot. Because you know, we don't have fig trees and cattle and all that kind of thing. But what he's saying is, the things that he mentions are the staples of their economy. He's saying, if our economy totally collapses and there's nothing to eat, you ever worry about that? You know, those of us who are older really didn't worry about that sort of thing much in the past. But I would imagine that all of us, at least a little bit, have a little bit of concern there. Basically what he's saying is this. In our terms, you go to Walmart, there's no milk, there's no eggs, even worse, there's no toilet paper. Why did people panic about that? I'm not going to get into that. Never mind. But if all of the staples, you remember when they shut that pipeline down? You remember when that happened not too long ago and you couldn't get gas? You remember that? This is what Habakkuk is saying. The pipelines are shut down. The water doesn't work. There's no gasoline. You go to Walmart, there's no food there. This is the situation Habakkuk is imagining, because that's what's going to happen. And he says, even though that's the case, verse 18, yet I will exult in the Lord. Notice that he's making a decision. Notice he's making a commitment. Notice he's making a choice. Notice that he's saying, here's the event. What am I going to choose? My what? My response. And I'm going to exult in the Lord. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength, and he has made my feet like hinds feet, and makes me walk on my high places. The worst is almost never going to happen. But guess what? When it does, you still don't have to be devastated because of your relationship with God. Well, one more thing quickly and we're done. I know what you're thinking. Now, I don't know in Exodus 16, I don't know that the Israelites meant this, but I think maybe they did. When they say to Moses, you've brought us out here to kill us. It's like they're accusing Moses, the reason you brought us out here was to kill us. The reason that you came and delivered us from Egypt was to get us into the wilderness to kill us. They're accusing Moses of being a homicidal maniac. They say, I know what you're thinking, Moses. You wanted to kill us. You say, well, that's ludicrous. And of course it is. But when things get difficult, do we ever get irrational? When things get difficult, do we ever start thinking some things that maybe not be realistic? Of course we do. And one of the ways that we do that is toward other people. We start to imagine that other people are up to something they're not. That other people are thinking something they're not. That other people are doing something against us that they aren't. And we've got to be careful about that. It's called mind reading. And we say, I know what you're thinking. I know what you're doing. I know what you're up to. The fact is that you don't. You don't know. And we've got to be careful about mind reading. Well, next week, Lord willing, we're going to look at the final miracle in Exodus for the series, Exodus 17 and verses 8 to 16. Tonight, Lord willing, we will be back here at 6 p.m. for the monthly Bible study. We've been looking at the second coming, and tonight we'll be in 1 Thessalonians 3 through 5. So take out your songbook and turn to the invitation song, and we'll sing that in just a moment. Difficulty is a given. It is a certainty. It's always going to happen. It's always going to happen. The question is never, am I going to suffer? The question is always, how will I choose to suffer? The Israelites blew it. And you know what happened? They were judged. They were punished. They suffered more because they suffered poorly. And the same thing happens to us. We've got to be careful. Why does it matter? Because the life that you live, the way that you live, the happiness that you have, the level of accomplishment in the things that are important to you depend on how you handle difficulty. Your loved ones are affected by the way you handle difficulty. The people that you love are either helped or hurt by the way you handle hardship. It's worth getting right. Your relationship with God is affected. God will judge us when we do not handle adversity well. And we can have no influence. If we're panicky, if we're grumpy, if we're gripey, if we're sour and combative, who in the world is going to look at us and say, well, that person's a Christian, and they're grumpy, and they complain, and they bicker with people all the time. I think I'd like to be one of them. Because you can have all that without being a Christian. And it's a lot easier. You don't have to give up a Sunday morning. But when we handle difficulty well, I would suggest that this is the thing that gets the world's attention more than anything else. The world is going to notice not your quoting of Scripture, not your religious devotion. The world is going to notice your handling adversity well more than anything else, and will have a bigger impact on people than anything else that we do. It's really important to get right. This morning, it may be that you are not a Christian. You're not a believer. You're not serving God because you've never started that relationship. We'd love to help you to do that. If you've decided that it's time, we can do that this morning. If you're still thinking about it and you've got some questions, we'd love to study with you. Get those questions answered, right, so we can make a decision. If you are a Christian and there's some difficulty that you have that you need help with, we want to help you. We're here to help you. God created local churches so we could come together and help one another. And we'd love to help you this morning. Whatever your need, we'd love to speak privately after church, or you can come forward, take a seat on the front as we stand and sing.